may I take this opportunity to thank the Arts Council of England, as always, without whom there wouldn't really be a festival, not in the way we know it. And I would like to thank our sponsors for this event, Mr. and Mrs. Houghton, ceramicists of this parish, whose work may be seen at number 9 Bankside Studios off the Little Markle Road. They are always welcoming and will offer you a tea. Which reminds me that the only difference between the words pottery and poetry is indeed tea. That's terrible. Edmund de Waal, an artist, he's an artist whose material is porcelain, an interest that first began at the age of 5 and much later developed into the desire with which we are familiar, the moving away from the making of single objects to the production of groups of pieces to be experienced in relation to the space they are in. He has worked in many spaces, from Southwark Cathedral to the Turner Contemporary, and is always pushing the boundaries a little further. If you go online, you can see his present exhibition in Berlin. He has introduced huge, really interesting black containers for his ceramics. And his titles are like those of poems: Black Milk, Against Poetry, My Problem with the Frankfurt School, On the Eve of Departure, Rag Picker. When he left Cambridge, he moved to Herefordshire, living the life of the rural potter, which he described as the whole lychee thing. I dug my own clay, I made my own wood ash, I built my own kiln, and I made absolutely god-awful functional pots. It was a time that Edmund now describes as a bit dogged. He sold a few things at craft shops and at the Hereford Market, and lived very cheaply on root vegetables. Anybody who has read The Hare with the Amber Eyes will know how Edmund de Waal became entranced by his family's 264 netsuke and how he traced his family past through this collection. He does so in a wonderfully graceful and engaging way, just as he takes the reader on a trip to discover the history of porcelain in the White Road. Now, we have the opportunity to hear him talk about the poems that have mattered to him throughout his life, and the man asking the questions is the festival's patron, Mark Fisher, who came to inaugurate the festival in 1998 when he was Minister for the Arts. Since retiring from politics, he was MP for Stoke-on-Trent for 27 years, and what a wonderful ceramic link that is with this event. He has helped the festival in many ways, not least by becoming its patron. He is a passionate arts activist and has been a film producer, screenwriter, a playwright, author, and in his student days, a waiter, a folk singer, and a guitarist. Please welcome them both.
Thank you, Peter. Always completely unrecognisable, most of it untrue, but thank you very much. Now, you've done such a good job on touching bases on Edmund that I don't need to do that. But this is a first for us doing Desert Island Poems, because Edmund, as Peter indicated, has roots here in Herefordshire, indeed really, really local, which we will no doubt at some point explore. We've never had anybody doing Desert Island Poems who really has rooted in his origins here. We'll come to that in a moment. Edmund, did Peter mention that you got a first in English at Cambridge?
We don't talk about that, actually. We can talk about Herefordshire.
The first in English is very relevant because of his choices, his really interesting and informed choices of poems today. So no good you being self-effacing and embarrassed. It is crucial.
I try and do my body language differently. Okay.
So when did you... Where did you first begin to love poetry?
Poetry was always there. I mean, I really do think poetry was always there. Lucky to have a house with poems on shelves, poetry books on shelves. Very lucky about that. Very, very lucky about that. But very lucky to have an argumentative family So lots of words and lots of discussion. But poems became sort of self-adopted very, very early on, actually. I think we lived in various cathedral towns, Lincoln and then in Canterbury. But there was always this cottage, this very beautiful cottage up Rolleston, up towards the Black Mountains, And there was always this other place, which was Herefordshire, border country. And so that actually connected me pretty early on to some very serious poems and poets, because just down the lane from our little cottage was a watermill where Francis Horowitz and Roger Garfitt lived. Much beloved, much beloved people who many of you will know and remember. So right from very early on, there were poets nearby, which is, good, dangerous neighbours to have. Mm.
I know that your mother is in the audience, is that right? What were the first poems that she read to you? Can you remember?
Damn.
Sorry.
This suddenly feels like a Cambridge supervision, actually. No, I can't remember that, but I remember in her study, she's a writer, that there was Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and I remember there was Auden and all kind of Robert Lowell. I mean, she was a pretty good reader of things. The connection from early on, though, which actually was a visual connection, which turned into totally catalytic, fabulous beginnings, was walking across the hills from our cottage to Capperley Finn near Lantoni. In the Black Mountains, where Eric Gill lived in his chaotic, complex way, with David Jones. And there on the walls of the monastery in Capperley Finn was an extraordinary wall painting of a crucifixion by David Jones. So very, very early on, David Jones was part of the whole setup, even before very quickly after that, I discovered his poems.
Well, you're a dream interviewee, because without being rehearsed at all, we've come to the first poem there, which is David Jones.
Well, we could just have a lock-in and just talk about David Jones no one would mind, I'm sure. David Jones, obviously poet, obviously calligrapher, letterer, painter, watercolourist, letter writer, but also someone who thinks about landscape. This is from The Sleeping Lord, Late Fragments, and a beautiful, extraordinary poem called The Tutelar of the Place. Just a section of that. Queen, it's a prayer. Queen of the differentiated sites, administratrix of the demarcations, let our cry come unto you. In all times of imperium, save us when the marcatories come, save us from the guile, save us from the missi, from the agents who think no shame, by inquest to audit what is shameful to tell, deliver us. When they check their capitularies and their curias, confuse their reckonings. When they narrowly assess the trivers by head, by hide, by rod, by pentan, by pent, by impost and fee on beast head and roof tree, and number the souls of men, notch their tallies false, disorder what they have collated. When they prescribe the diverse uses and impose the rootless uniformities, pray for us. When they sit in council to liquidate the holy diversities, mother of particular perfections, queen of otherness, mistress of asymmetry, patroness of things counter, party, pied, several, protectress of things known and handled, help of things familiar and small, wardress of the secret crevices, of things wrapped and hidden, mediatrix of all the deposits, margravine of the Troia, empress of the labyrinth, receive our prayers. When they come with writs of ire and termina to hear the false and determine the evil, in the bland megapolitan light, where no shadow is by day or by night, be our shadow. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's dense stuff.
Yeah.
But it's Herefordshire.
Well, it's a pretty wonderful start, I mean, to a poetry life. But moving on, you were then sent to King's Canterbury, where yes. your father was he dean?
He was dean, yeah.
He was dean.
Yeah.
And there was a teacher at King's Canterbury who was important.
Yes, I mean, it's that thing about every time you talk about poetry, everyone says, and there was one person, there yeah. was one teacher. It's why poetry in schools matters so much. There was one teacher, a man called Andrew Dobbin, who did that thing a very, very good teacher does, which is to look you in the eye and not realise how old you are. And so he taught me brilliantly by just treating me as an adult. And he introduced me to remarkable people, and it was... by this point, I was also writing poetry a lot, a huge amount as well. But he introduced me to Coleridge, and Coleridge became, you know, there was David Jones doing his dense, wonderful, embedded language thing. And then there was Coleridge being lyrical, but doing the kind of inward voice thing. And Coleridge became hugely, hugely important to me.
So that's your second poem?
That's my second poem. And again, you know, it's far too long, but a tiny bit of Frost at Midnight won't do anyone any harm. The frost performs its secret ministry, unhelped by any wind. The owlet's cry came loud, and hark again, loud as before. The inmates of my cottage, all at rest, have left me to that solitude which suits abstruser musings, save that at my side my cradled infant slumbers peacefully. 'Tis calm indeed, so calm that it disturbs and vexes meditation with its strange and extreme silentness. Sea, hill and wood, this populous village, sea and hill and wood, with all the numberless goings on of life, inaudible as dreams. The thin blue flame lies on my low-burnt fire and quivers not. Only that film, which fluttered on the grate, still flutters there, the sole unquiet thing. Methinks its motion is this hush of nature, gives its dim sympathies with me who live, making it a companionable form, whose puny flaps and freaks the idling spirit by its own moods interprets, everywhere echo or mirror seeking of itself, and makes a toy of thought. I mean, that is pretty cool writing, because it's thinking, it's that measured way in which he changes his thinking. Mm. He's actually thinking aloud.
And it rises beyond itself.
So it's that marvellous thing about which almost no one else does, which is that thing about being totally sort of almost trapped within your own consciousness, and then suddenly something, some perception just picks you up and takes you back into the world again, and then back you go into thoughts. It's that thinking aloud is remarkable.
If you go in afterwards and buy read... have already read Edmund's The White Road about porcelain. He has a wonderful passage in that in which he explains his love of porcelain, and it comes from the earth, it aspires to air, it's closer to glass, making of porcelain, there is an alchemical change, a mystery, something happens, and that of course is at the root of all poetry as well.
Yes, I mean, the thing is, you can't legislate for alchemy. You can put everything out there on the table. And in my case, it's sort of clay and glazes, and there's fire over there in the corner, and it all has to come together. But you can't legislate for it coming right. Just as when you try and make language into poetry, you know, it doesn't work most of the time, but sometimes, you know, the kiln opens and there's a poem. You know, it can work. It can work.
Wonderful. So that brings you to your late teens, and then at 17 you went off to Japan, did you? Where you had relations.
So all childhood I'm making pots. You know, pots and poems. That's what I was going to be. Except that poems weren't very good. In fact, my pots weren't very good either, come to think of it, actually. But passionate about pottery, passionate about poetry. And then there's Japan, and Japan is, of course, the potter's country. It's the place where, famously, you can get in a cab and your taxi driver will talk to you about pottery. It doesn't actually happen here very often. And so I went off and had a wonderful summer doing tea ceremony and no drama, and did my first sort of proper visit to all these wonderful kilns, these wonderful pottery villages, and so made my first pots in Japan, and was very evangelical about it. I was very taken up with this whole leech thing about, yeah.
And before then, you'd be mainly making sort of Bernard Leach brown British pots, didn't you?
Well, Leach is brown across the world. So he's brown Japanese and brown English. He brings both those brownnesses together and makes a particular school of pottery, which is... And that was why I went to Japan. I went to go and touch the flame, really, come close to the flame of that whole tradition. And the man I was already studying with and then was apprenticed with as soon as I got back from Japan, Geoffrey Whiting, who was a wonderful studio potter, absolutely in that tradition. I mean, he made pots that he said were cheap enough to drop. You know, they had to be functional pots that you could use day in, day out, and it didn't matter if they dropped. And they had a quietness, an austerity, they almost faded into the background, self-consciously faded into the background, if you can pardon that thought. And so he sort of sent me to Japan, and I came back and I did a proper 18-month apprenticeship with him, making 250 soup bowls. You know, they would all be lined up. He would say that one was okay. 249 would be broken up. And then I'd get back on the wheel again. He was tough.
And is this when you first experienced Japanese poetry?
Yes. I mean, well, it'd been a sort of undercurrent, but going to Japan, of course, you can't go to Japan without that whole landscape. That's probably a prompt, isn't it?
It was, it's slightly, actually, yes. Very subtle.
God, you're good, Mark. Yes, so you can't go around Japan without thinking about haiku, without thinking about Japanese poetry, because the whole landscape, is, of course, embedded in poetry. Everyone, when you go to Japan, you go to a beautiful hillside there, written in beautiful calligraphy, carved into wood, the bottom of a mountain is a haiku. You know, you go up some temple and there are a series of... You come down again and your taxi driver, learned taxi driver, says, you know, I wrote some tanka, some about that temple. And it all comes back, well, mostly comes back to Basho, the great traveller who walks through Japan in his moth-eaten coat, miserable as sin, writing a diary and occasionally writing poems. The Narrow Road to the Deep North by Basho, this is the beginning. And it ends in a poem. Days and months are travellers of eternity. So are the years that pass by. Those who steer a boat across the sea or drive a horse across the earth till they succumb to the weight of years spend every minute of their lives travelling. There are a great number of ancients too who died on the road. I myself have been tempted for a long time by the cloud-moving wind. It's great. Filled with a strong desire to wander. It was only towards the end of last autumn that I returned from rambling along the coast. I barely had time to sweep the cobwebs from my broken house on the River Sumida before the new year, but no sooner had the spring mist begun to rise over the field than I wanted to be on the road again, to cross the barrier gate of Shirakawa in due time. The gods seemed to have possessed my soul and turned it inside out, and roadside images seemed to invite me from every corner, so that it was impossible for me to stay idle at home. Even while I was getting ready, mending my torn trousers, tying a new strap to my hat, and applying moxa to my legs to strengthen them, I was already dreaming of the full moon rising over the isles of Matsushima. Finally, I sold my house, moving to the cottage of Sampu for a temporary stay. Upon the threshold of my own home, however, I wrote a linked verse of 8 pieces and hung it on a wooden pillar. The starting piece was, "Behind this door, now buried in deep grass, a different generation will celebrate the Festival of Dolls." And then he's off. And then he's off. And he doesn't get back for months. And he comes back with terrible aches, ague in his limbs, you know, bitten by mosquitoes, having had his knapsack stolen by some drunken traveller, and with poems. It's just the greatest thing. Get on the road and write poems. It's terrific.
Right. Well, that with this new taste of Japan, you returned to Cambridge, where you were taught by Geoffrey Hill.
I was taught...
Pretty lucky.
I read English, and I was taught by... Yes. You see, the thing is, the great thing about Cambridge is you could do what you want, and you could ask people to supervise you. And so I asked Jeremy Prynne, you know, famously prickly, difficult, cussed, bloody-minded poet, terrific, to teach me Pound, which was interesting. And I asked Geoffrey, who died last week, and who I miss with great intensity, to supervise me on David Jones. And so I used to go to his rooms in Emmanuel, which were just with more books than you've... rabbinical Bible books. And there he was in black, with his black beard at that point. He used to call me Mr. Duval. It was terrifying, absolutely terrifying. He did the absolutely... God, it was terrifying. when you said something that he thought was stupid, he would go silent. And the silence would lengthen and lengthen and lengthen until you had to unpick in the silence your utter idiocy. But he was wonderful on David Jones, and I wrote about David Jones for my final year dissertation with him supervising me. And, you know, in honour of the late, lamented, I mean, again, you know, any book of his poems, those early poems, Tenebrae in particular, beautiful, but actually because we're here, Mercy, you know, it has to be Mercy and Hymns.
Absolutely.
Just, can I just a few of Mercy and Hymns? This is the greatest, one of the greatest books of the 20th century. King of the perennial holly groves, the riven sandstone, overlord of the M5, architect of the historic rampart and ditch, the citadel at Tamworth, the summer hermitage in Holy Cross, guardian of the Welsh Bridge and the Iron Bridge, contractor to the desirable new estates, saltmaster, money changer, commissioner for oaths, martyrologist, the friend of Charlemagne. I like that, said Offa. Sing it again. And then just two more.
Yes, please.
Yeah. A pet name, a common name, best-selling brand, Kurt Graffito, a laugh, a cough, a syndicate, a specious gift, scoffed at horn phonograph, the starting cry of a race, a name to conjure with. And then actually this heartbreaking one, which is for his grandmother, which is him bringing Offa together. He grew up in Wolverhampton. Mm. That's right, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And this is one of the last in the Mercian hymns, which is about his grandmother. And it's also about Ruskin, which you won't have time for this afternoon or possibly tomorrow. Brooding on the 80th letter of Fors Clavigera, I speak of this in memory of my grandmother, whose childhood and prime womanhood was spent in the nailer's darg. The nail shop stood back of the cottage by the fold. It reeked stale mineral sweat. Sparks had furred its low roof. In dawnlight, the troughed water floated a damson bloom of dust, not to be shaken by posthumous clamour. It is one thing to celebrate the quick forge, another to cradle a face hair-lipped by the searing wire, brooding on the 80th letter of Thor's clavigera. I speak this in memory of my grandmother, whose childhood and prime womanhood was spent in the nailer's darg. And do you know what? There's clay on this page. I must have had this on in the studio. It's one of the most extraordinary poems. That it's a lament, but it's so fierce, that lament. And he takes to task in that those few lines, Ruskin and his nobling spirit about work, and he just takes it searingly apart and says, yes, work is noble, but look at my grandmother, you know, and brings it all back to this bit of country. It's terrific stuff.
A well-spent period at Cambridge. But the other person who you you read a lot of at Cambridge, I think I'm right in saying, is Wallace Stevens,
yeah.
who is far too easily forgotten these days. But if anybody you like Wallace Stevens, there is a wonderful life of him by Lucy Beckett that I thoroughly recommend to you. But you're going to read us a Wallace Stevens.
Yeah, so Wallace Stevens sort of erupted into my life because there's all this sort of dense language going on. And Pound and Geoffrey Hill and David Jones. But then there was Wallace Stevens. And Wallace Stevens is a fabulous acquired taste because he's metaphysical. You know, he takes ideas enormously seriously. He's the opposite of lucid. It's dense, beautiful, gravid language. It's like being in a river. But he writes the only poem about a pot ever. And if someone's going to say Rubaiyat of Obakam or blah, blah, blah. This is the only poem ever written about a pot. It's called Anecdote of the Jar. It's about why pots matter. I placed a jar in Tennessee, and round it was, upon a hill. It made the slovenly wilderness surround that hill. The wilderness rose up to it and sprawled around, no longer wild. The jar was round upon the ground and tall and of a port in air. It took dominion everywhere. The jar was grey and bare. It did not give of bird or bush like nothing else in Tennessee.
Wonderful.
Excellent. We should just stop there and just...
I thought I knew Wallace Stevenson, but I didn't know that, and that's wonderful, isn't it?
It's that fantastic. Extraordinary moment, you know, it's so extraordinary, that language. And it's that thing for me, of course, it's taking seriously, like David Jones talking about being things known and handled. That takes what happens when you put an object down in the world, everything else stops, which is my idiotic...
Not at all.
Life.
It's what you've done. So, Cambridge, important years. Jim Eade, and anybody who loves Kettle's Yard will know and love Jim Eade's and Jim and Helen Eade's work. And we were both lucky enough to know him, weren't we?
Yeah, so Jim Eade, who did this extraordinary house at Kettle's Yard, which is, you know, Hepworth and Ben Nicholson and Alfred Wallace... Lucy Rhee, books, Gaudier Breschka, and a house, you know, where you
stones.
Sit. And stones, beautifully, yes. Yes, stones in a spiral. But also a place where you could just go and sit and read and be quiet. I basically spent crazy amounts of time either in Kettle's Yard or actually in the Fitzwilliam. That was my Cambridge.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Good life. But also John Berryman.
Yes. So that's when I began to really read American poetry as well. I really, it was nothing but poetry, actually, in Cambridge. Well, it was really nothing. It's really been nothing but poetry forever, actually, to be absolutely frank. Yes, Berryman. Now, Berryman mattered because there was a prickliness about Berryman, an anger, and a humour, about him that I loved. And also, we may come back to this or may not, there was something about... I was still trying to write poems, but sort of giving up by this point. But there was something about Berryman, particularly his dream songs, which he did for the latter part of his life, which sort of a non-sonnet, basically, an 18-line poem, where everything turns up, everything he cares about turns up in these poems. And I was trying to think about pots at this time and trying to think, how can I get everything into a pot? And John Berryman always was out there for me thinking, how do you get everything into one verse? So just two very quick, if we're allowed, two John Berrymans.
Yes.
Berryman, deep in drink, troubled and locked away in for both by choice and not by choice in different institutions, has a great persona called Henry, who is his alter ego. Huffy Henry hid the day. Unappeasable Henry sulked. I see his point. A trying to put things over. It was the thought that they thought they could do it made Henry wicked and away, but he should have come out and talked. All of the world, like a woolen lover, once did seem on Henry's side. Then came a departure. Thereafter, nothing fell out as it might or would. I don't see how Henry, pried open for all the world to see, survived. What he has now to say is a long wonder the world can bear and be. Once in a sycamore I was glad, all at the top, and I sang. Hard on the land where's the strong sea, and empty grows every bed. It's really, really beautiful stuff. And then just the poem that I read to my children, and they try and shut me up, but I go right the way through to the end. This is the essential parental poem to children. Life, friends, is boring. We must not say so. After all, the sky flashes, the great sea yearns, we ourselves flash and yearn. And moreover, my mother told me as a boy repeatedly, ever to confess you're bored means you have no inner resources. I conclude now I have no inner resources because I am heavy bored. Peoples bore me, literature bores me, especially great literature. Henry bores me with his plights and gripes as bad as Achilles, who loves people and valiant art, which bores me. And the tranquil hills and gin look like a drag, and somehow a dog has taken itself and its tail considerably away into mountains or sea or sky, leaving behind me, wag. Inner Resources, the great parental poem.
But there were other more conventional parts of your Cambridge poetry life. I mean, apart from Stevens and Geoffrey Hill, there's Marvell and Herbert.
Yes,
I
mean...
Give us a Herbert.
I can give you a Herbert. Yes. I mean, to be honest, you know, all this stuff, it was just wonderful. I just had a ball at Cambridge. Partly, I have to say, because I knew I wasn't going to be an academic. I knew I was a potter. And so having 3 years reading poetry and writing about it seemed to me about as good as it could ever get. Herbert had happened earlier. Herbert really, as a teenager, was pretty significant to me. And that, again, that sort of, that fierce, I keep coming back to that word, I suppose it matters to me, that unequivocal attention, metaphysical attention to not getting away with how ideas form, and to the complexity of God, you know, the problem of God, which is so present in Herbert and of course Traherne Over the Hill, but then just gloriousness, and therefore Easter. Rise, heart. Thy Lord is risen, sing his praise without delays. who take thee by the hand, that thou likewise with him mayst rise, that as his death calcine thee to dust, his life may make thee gold and more, much more just. Awake, my lute, and struggle for thy part with all thy art. The cross taught all wood to resound his name who bore the same. His sinewed stretch taught all strings what key is best to celebrate this most high day. Consort both heart and lute and twist a song pleasant and long. Or since all music is but three parts vied and multiplied, O let thy blessed spirit bear a part and make up our defects with his sweet art. I got me flowers to straw thy way. I got me boughs off many a tree, but thou wast up by break of day and brought thy sweets along with thee. The sun arising in the east, though he give light and the east perfume, if they should offer to contest with thy arising, they presume, can there be any day but this? Though many suns to shine endeavour, we count 300, but we miss. There is but one, and that one ever. It's heartbreaking, isn't it? It's absolutely extraordinary. And actually, calcining to dust.
So you'd laid down an incredibly rich background for yourself in Cambridge, and then you went back to Japan, and everybody in this room would have read Hair with Amber Eyes, but you tell almost. If you haven't, there's a copy at the back.
It's all right. It's all right.
And you followed your Afruzzi family.
Yes.
Netsuke roots.
Yeah, so I mean, I was a potter by then and had tried it out badly in Herefordshire. If you can never find those pots I made in Herefordshire, then they're worth a huge amount of money, much to my horror. £2 for a casserole. But at that point I was making porcelain. Then I got a chance to go to Japan, back to Japan. For a couple of years and on a scholarship, and I made pots there and started using porcelain really seriously and with great pressure there. I started writing a book about Bernard Leach, spending my days doing research on the early life of Bernard Leach, which turned out to be a kind of a book which let me shed myself of his. It was a patricidal book, someone said. But then I also spent almost every afternoon with my ancient, aging, and very beloved great uncle Iggy, this very remarkable and lovely man, then in his 80s, Austrian aristocrat, who was a banker and had been living in Japan since the war, with his room looking out over Tokyo, with his partner Jiro, with his apartment next door, and all his books in German and French, and this vitrine with all these Japanese Netsuke, and he began to talk to me, because it was that extraordinary moment of synergy that happens sometimes, if you're lucky, with someone at a particular point in their life, when actually, if you're there, you listen. And there are stories. And he began to tell me these stories. And then he died a couple of years later, and I went back to his funeral, and I buried him with his partner, Shiro, by my side. And then I found out that I had inherited this collection of Netsuke. And then I had to work out what to do. And so I did that whole ridiculous 7-year journey to try and work out what they all meant, which ended up as a book.
Not ridiculous at all.
Actually, pretty ridiculous, because it was pretty bloody hard work, actually. Entre nous, Mark.
Well, I'm sure it was, but it was not ridiculous. I think it's given huge pleasure and stimulus to everybody in this audience.
Apart from the person who hasn't read it, in row 7. I will give you a copy, by the way.
So, yeah. You start to make porcelain, but also you are by now in love, is that right?
I've been in love for a long time. Now, I met my wife, Sue, who can't be here today, but in Cambridge, and we were together pretty well straight away after Cambridge. And she worked abroad a lot. She worked in international development. And so we came, went. Finally, back in London, living together, and then three children, who are now taller than me.
Wonderful. How does Rilke come into this?
Rilke comes into this because, in rather a cool way, actually, because doing the research for The Hair with Amber Eyes took me very kind of deep into this European life, the family, and one of the things that I'd always known was that my grandmother Elizabeth, to whom I used to send poems as a teenager, and she would send them back corrected, had been a poet.
What a grandmother.
Yes, and she lived with, she was quite something, and she lived with, you know, with books in every European language on her walls.
Is that your mother's mother? Or
no, it's my father's mother.
Oh, really?
Yes, Elizabeth de Waal. And she... I knew that she'd known Rilke, but then actually in the research for it, discover just how well she knew Rilke, and that there were all these letters, extraordinary letters, between her and Rilke. And then came across not only the correspondence, but then all the other connections with Rilke that she had. So as a young woman, well-brought-up woman, she'd written to Rilke, and Rilke had written back. How cool is that? And then she'd sent her poems to him, and he'd corrected her poems. And then, unbelievably coolest thing of all time, he'd sent her the sonnets to Orpheus.
Wow.
In manuscript. So, but that's not what we're going to read. Because it's just a bit of
the elegy.
Just the beginning of the first Duino elegy. And I was reading this on the train up, and I'm a bit narc because I actually haven't brought my favourite translation. So you'll have to forgive this translation. Still quite good, actually, but it's not the best. Who, if I cried out, would hear me among the angelic orders? And even if one were to suddenly take me to its heart, I would vanish into its stronger existence. For beauty is nothing but the beginning of terror that we are still able to bear. And we revere it so because it calmly disdains to destroy us. Every angel is terror. And so I hold myself back and swallow the cry of a darkened sobbing. Ah, who then can we make use of? Not angels, not men. And the resourceful creatures see clearly that we are not really at home in the interpreted world. Perhaps there remains some tree on a slope that we can see again each day. There remains to us yesterday's street and the thinned out loyalty of a habit that liked us and so stayed and never departed. Oh, and the night when the wind full of space wears out our faces. Whom would she not stay for, the longed-for, gentle, disappointing one, whom the solitary heart with difficulty stands before? Is she less heavy for lovers? They only hide their fate between themselves. Do you know yet? Throw out the emptiness out of your arms to add to the spaces we breathe. Maybe the birds will feel the expansion of air in more intimate flight. Yeah, it bears rereading.
It does.
But that idea of that space that Rilke does lyrically, which is to kind of which is pretty sui generis, which is a sort of a space of thinking and aspiration and inspiration and totally grounded at the same moment. Lyrically, it's extraordinary in German. I mean, if you hear it in German, it really is quite something. And there are now 70 years of failed attempts to come close to it. But the idea of terror, and emptiness and solitude, and the necessity for terror, that encounter with terror, I think is amazing actually in Rilke.
Now, sadly, we're coming to the end. We've got two more poems. And anybody who saw the Anselm Kiefer exhibition will see the way he was enormously influenced by Paul Celan, and you're going to give us one Paul Celan, aren't you? Why? Why is he important for you?
Celan, I first encountered actually through Geoffrey Hill.
Really?
A long time ago. He translated, he did a version of Celan.
Really?
I did a poem, an elegy for him. Very, very beautiful. It's in Tenebrae. We hear too late or not too late is the last line. We hear too late or not too late. Incredible. So Celan, the great Romanian-born Jewish writer of the 20th century, writes in German. German becomes more and more and more painful and difficult and tricky for him because his parents are killed. And he's the great poet of white. He's the great... White inhabits his poems. White is constant. He says, white is the colour of my mother's hair she never saw. White is homecoming. White is the place... And he died. He kills himself. But white in his poetry is extraordinary because his poems become shorter and shorter and shorter and more and fragmentary. And so you're actually getting two poems.
Right.
And I'm sorry, this is actually in German and then in English. Right. This is Heimkehr. Schneevoll dichter und dichter, taben farben wir gestern, Schneevoll erschläft du auch jetzt noch, weifen gelachtes Weiß, dürrehin endlos die Schleitenspur der Verloren, darunter geborgen, stülpt sich empor, was der Augen so weit tut, Hügel um Hügel unsichtbar. Auf jedem, heimgehüllt in seiner Häute, eins in stummer Engelchen Sicht, holzen ein Flock, dort ein Gutfuhl, vom Eiswind herübergeweht, das sein Tauben, sein Schnee, Farben, Warntuch festmacht. Homecoming. Snowfall, denser and denser, dark-coloured as yesterday's snowfall, as even now you were sleeping. White, stacked into distance. Above it, endless, the sleigh track of the lost. Below, hidden, presses up what so hurt the eyes, hill upon hill invisible. On each, fetched home into its today, an eye slipped away into dumbness, wooden, a post. There, a feeling blown across by the ice wind, attaching its dove, its snow-coloured cloth, as a flag. And then just, sorry,
oh.
Sorry, just...
Oh, no, don't apologise.
This is just in English, but... sorry, in German and in English. Very short. Wir lagen schärf tief in der Machia, als du endlich herankorst, doch könnten wir nicht hinüberdunkeln zu dir. Es herrschte Lichtzwang. We were lying deep in the Machia by the time you crept up at last, but we could not darken over to you. Light compulsion reigned. He makes words happen. He brings words together. So Lichtzwang doesn't exist. It's light and compulsion. He brings these words together and makes new things. It's alchemy. And I did an installation for Vienna and I in a museum, and I called it Lichtzwang, light compulsion, bringing these things together with passion.
Now to our last, just as that brings us back to light and whiteness, your last poem is by Emily Dickinson, which brings us the whole idea of fragments and brokenness, and which underpins an awful lot of what you make.
Yeah, Emily Dickinson. After great pain, a formal feeling comes. The nerves sit ceremonious like tombs. The stiff heart questions. Was it he that bore? And yesterday or centuries before, the feet mechanical go round a wooden way of ground or air or aught. Regardless grown, a quartz contentment like a stone. This is the hour of lead, remembered if outlived, as freezing persons recollect the snow, first chill, then stupor, then the letting go. That's a great poem.
Well.
And Fragments.
Yes.
You know, that is Emily Dickinson.
Yeah.
That is Emily Dickinson. Shards.
The question that must be in everybody's mind after The White Road and all your recent exhibitions and your show at the Royal Academy is, where do you go next? And
So I'm lucky. So at the moment it's Berlin, and then this autumn I'm curating an exhibition at the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna on anxiety. I've chosen all the objects in the museum that worry me most. And then...
Is it a big exhibition?
It's a big exhibition. It's called During the Night. And then next year I'm doing an exhibition with Mirandi, the Mirandi Foundation, in a beautiful museum in Stockholm on the water. So, you know, does it get better?
But where is your own work going?
This is my work. No, this is, I'm making work in response...
For those jokes.
Yes. Ah. So this is... So with the Kunsthistorische, it's anxious things, and I've made a huge anxious vitrine full of things that... It's full of lead. And then for Stockholm, it's Mirandi's paintings and drawings, and then it's I've made a whole new series of works which are sort of me talking aloud to Mirandi. So, you know, it's
can't wait.
Thank you.
Can't wait. Now, you will want to ask questions.
They may not, actually.
Of course they will. You will want to ask questions. Is there a mic around?
Yes, there is.
While we're waiting for our first thing, I actually... this is a Shard Fumark, which is porcelain shard, which is a bit of poetry, because it has a teeny touch of gold on it. So I thought that's my bit of.
I'm hugely touched. Thank you very much. Yes. Thank you very much indeed. A question? Yes. Peter is there with a mic.
Edmund, a very simple question. How hard is it to throw a pot?
It's as hard as it is to play a note on a piano. Which is to say that it's not hard at all. It's a series of movements. It's a learned thing. It's a way of making a volume, making a space in a solid. It's a rhythm. It's a caesura. It's a pause. So not difficult at all. But like listening to, like putting that note, that finger down on a piano, that as soon as you've done it once, you actually start to think, actually, what would happen if I did it again? You know, so that cadence of making it again and again and again, it's a pretty fabulous way of spending as much time as you have. Do you make pots?
But
well then,
part of the answer.
I just wanted to basically sort of comment on it's technically warning people. There's a sort of red tape warning about certain materials, such as the lead and the asbestos in the lining of the kilns that they have. It's just in my experience, my journey of pottery. Mm-hmm. I think it's amazing that there's not more explicit warning about selling lead bowls that may leach.
Yeah.
the fruit salad, no leech, yeah. Then the unborn fetus and the pregnant woman, who's actually bought the mold.
Well, ceramics has always been attended by danger. This last book I wrote, The White Road, is really a long, perhaps too long, disquisition on dust, on white dust, which is what you breathe when you... And of course, there's a very salutary warnings that you bring up. Yes.
Question here.
Forward question. Archaic torso of Apollo.
Sorry?
Archaic torso of Apollo is my question.
Yeah. So it's a real Kean question of fantastic, beautiful complexity. I unfortunately can't recite it. Can you recite it? Damn. Okay. And the reason that matters to me is that when I went finally into the... So Rilke does this whole thing, which is about poems about things. Thing poems, which for someone who makes things and loves poetry is a pretty extraordinary thing to comprehend. And this is a wonderful poem amongst many wonderful Rilke poems. But when I went to Vienna and went into the old Palais in Vienna and walked in for the first time, there was Apollo standing there, a statue of that, which had been in the house. And I suddenly realized that my grandmother, who had been in that house all throughout her childhood and lived there, had this this both Rilke and Apollo in her life from nothing onwards. That's probably not what you wanted to hear.
Well, the last line seems to relate to your work also.
Yes, the last line. Go on.
You must change your life.
Well, you must change your life is the great aspiration constantly for all of us. You know, it's the great cry of Rilke. You must change your life. It's that thing that poetry does, which is to expand the space you live in. You know, again, you read a poem, it expands the space you live in. You know, you must change your life. It's there.
I wonder if you'd like to make some comment or give some thoughts about when pottery becomes art.
Pottery is always art. Pottery is one of the great, great arts. It's always been a great art. Its attention to materiality, to people, to space. It can be about narrative. It can be about eating and domestic life. It can be about the body. It can be about all kinds of things. But it's one of the great arts of the world. It's like singing. Pottery. So a lot of my working critical life has been spent trying to say, take it seriously. Take it seriously as an art. So when does pottery become an art? Begin again. It's always an art. And like all arts, it can be crap. Or it can be transcendent. But it is an art. Full stop.
I would love to hear one of your poems.
Where are you? Sorry. Oh God, no. They weren't very good. I was passionate about it. I also was, I have to say, as a teenager, in love with the girl in the bookshop, which is why I have so many Faber monographs. You know, those very thin Faber ones, which were sort of 80p.
I thought it was an amazing answer about the piano one note. I'm learning and I'm dreadful. And I'm a beginner thrower too. And I don't think
not having
possibly anybody could call me humble. You seem to be incredibly modest about everything you've achieved. And you've achieved an enormous lot. Do you feel that? And do you feel there's a reason for your... your style, as opposed to perhaps my...
Am I being asked how modest I am?
Yes.
That is... Peter, you can't ask someone on stage with a microphone in front of 120 people how modest they are. Because that's a totally bollocks question to ask someone. So I'm absolutely refusing that. And thank you for the pots you gave me, which are absolutely beautiful. So thank you.
Thank you. I think that's a great way to finish. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating. Please take away a little taste of Herefordshire with you, all the way from just down the road.
We had Westerns. This as children. We had this. Much Westerns is part of my childhood. Probably too much to mention.
Could I just remind you that there are books for sale down at the bottom? And also, can I just draw your attention to this fabulous publication, WAT, the anthology, published by Blood Axe, edited by Mark, and it contains 200 poems. For the price of a ticket, you can have poetry for life. Consider it. And you're supporting the festival at the same time. Thank you, Mark, for all the probing. And thank you for opening up and revealing so many things.
And that was just wonderful, Mark. The invitation to come here from you was absolutely fantastic. I've had a total... How can you not want to talk about poetry for an hour? It's been fantastic. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Edmund, you have given everybody in this room so much too, and to answer the answer to that very interesting question about the making of pottery, just look at Edmund's hands as he answers questions, and you sync that with his mind that he's revealed over the last hour, and you understand the alchemy. And I will stop there to not embarrass you, but
thank you.
It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.